Welcome to Crosstalk Bullhorns, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. Why is Trump powerless to compel Kiev and the Europeans? He claims they have no cards to play. Also, NATO throws down the gauntlet. Its Secretary General promises a World War II-style conflict on the European continent. To discuss these issues and more, I'm joined by my guest, George Samueli in Budapest. He's a podcaster at The Gaggle, which can be found on YouTube and Locals. And here in Moscow, we cross to Mark Sloboda. He's an international relations and security analyst. All right, gentlemen, crosstalk rules in effect. That means you can jump anytime you want, and I always appreciate it. All right, let's kick it off with Mark here in Moscow. We had this new national security strategy, which, of course, is not immediately translated into policy, rarely is, but it gives an indication of what the administration thinks. And then we have this ongoing process of at least some claiming to want to end the conflict in Ukraine. Well, we've done this so many times. I mean, what cards do the Europeans play? And if they have cards, why are they so powerful against Trump that seems so determined, at least rhetorically, to end this conflict?
Yeah, the new national security strategy, again, it's an idea. Implemented in policy is very hard, particularly with one as radical as this. But it does tell us that Trump, and at least an inner cadre around him within the administration, has nothing but contempt for the European ruling elite, which is no surprise. I mean, and it's a bit of payback. He has essentially...
Yeah, and they earned it, Mark. And they earned it.
Okay. He's called for political regime change in Europe, and they have act outrage towards that. But it should be remembered that the European ruling elite openly backed Trump's opponents in the last three election cycles. I mean, openly. So them crying, outrage at interference in European politics, it's a bit of, without any necessary political sympathy for Trump's brand of politics on my part, it's a bit of just desserts. And Trump has given us ultimatums now. I mean, he told the Kiev regime, Zelensky, this is what we heard from Dan Driscoll, the U.S. Army secretary, you need to sign on this line by Thanksgiving. Right. Or we'll cut off military aid and intelligence to the Kiev regime, and the Europeans had better get in line. And what happened? Nothing. That disappeared like smoke. And Trump's plan was replaced by a Ukrainian plan, which was replaced by a European plan, which was replaced by a new Trump plan, which Kiev has ignored. And now they put forward a new plan, not one of which Russia would ever agree to. So, I mean, they must be sitting back and scratching their heads at all of this. Now we've got another new ultimatum. Trump wants a deal by Christmas, which is a ridiculous deadline to set when it can't possibly be met. But it really makes the Trump administration look weak and, well, flaccid.
Well, yeah, also, and this is something in the recent past, is that the Russians aren't really part of this process. This is an inter-European, inter-NATO food fight in the cafeteria. That's what it looks like. It's not very serious. George, I'll posit why he's powerless, because he doesn't want to be blamed. And this is very much part of Trump's calculus, is that the writing is on the wall, but he doesn't want it to drop in his lap. He doesn't want this to be Kabul a la Trump. It's more of optics more than anything. Am I right?
I don't think so. I mean, he also doesn't really want to preside over the dissolution of NATO. I mean, NATO, it's been going now for more than 75 years, and like a bad marriage, I mean, it just simply goes on, and nobody really wants to break it up, even though they keep threatening and promising to do so. And I don't think Trump wants to leave office as the man who actually broke up NATO. So he kind of goes along with this, and he keeps saying, these NATO leaders are all very good friends of mine, and they're all great people, and so on. So he knows what needs to be done. I mean, it's clear that he knows what needs to be done. And what needs to be done is obviously abandon Zelensky and abandon the Europeans, because they are absolutely determined to keep this war going. and they're determined to suck the United States in ever deeper and keep this, you know, in the whole show on the road indefinitely. So, you know, Mark is absolutely right. I mean, the new things that they're coming up with are obviously calculated to ensure that it fails. So the latest is that, well, there'll be this economic free zones in the Donbass. I mean, it's absolute nonsense. And then, of course, Zelensky said, well, we need a referendum. That's it. That's a referendum. So,
but first we need security guarantees. We need security guarantees to have the referendum.
If we have a referendum, somebody has to guarantee the referendum. And then, of course, that's that's the moment when his Zelensky's European enablers say, yeah, and we'll send our forces in to guarantee security. So everything here is done in order to ensure that it will be rejected. And of course, Trump should just simply say, cut the whole thing off, but it's not happening. And so there's more and more meetings. And so we've now got another meeting planned with between Zelensky and Witkoff. And what are they going to be talking about? They're going to be talking about something that is obviously going to be unacceptable. And of course, inflation is that at some point, Trump will get angry, fed up, and he's going to blame Russia for it and say, "Yeah, it's all Putin's fault, and I trusted him, and I'm sick of it. You know, I'm really going to get tough with Putin now."
Yeah, but Mark, the theory, keep it going on. We all see that they don't want this conflict to end. But is that predicated on the assumption that Ukraine can win? See, that this is what doesn't make any sense.
Yeah, you're looking for logic. And there's no logic here. There's just hope that something will change, hope of a black swan event. They can ideologically, geopolitically, not accept the results of the failure of their proxy war in Ukraine, not just the failure of Russia, kicking their posteriors around the field in Ukraine. And they won't accept it, right? And no matter, the financial difficulties, now their desperation is to steal Russian assets in order to keep the war going because they're bankrupt themselves. Their military inventories are emptied. They just refuse to accept. They don't have a plan for victory, right? There is no plan for victory. The hope is just that if they keep it going long enough, Russia will just give up. The 25th round of sanctions or whatever will be the straw that breaks the camel's back finally. And it's... First of all, Trump needs to understand that no matter what, he's going to receive the blame. No matter what. Yeah. I mean, it doesn't make any difference. What he does, what he doesn't do, the Western media is going to blame him for, the collapse of the U.S. proxy regime in Ukraine. But I think it's a bit more than that, because he has leverage theoretically at his disposal, right? He could cut off the flow of military supplies and intelligence to the Kiev regime. He could do the same thing to the Europeans. He's used tariffs to get the Europeans online with trade policies already. He's threatened them. He's also threatened, tariffs and secondary sanctions against Russia. So why couldn't he do the same thing against the Europeans, right? Leverage his love for tariffs to get them in line. But he won't do it. Why? I think it's not just about blame. I think that institutionally, the U.S. president simply doesn't have that power when all of Congress, or the vast majority of it, when the deep state, the State Department, the Pentagon, the military-industrial complex, the intelligence services, the media, the entire rest of the U.S. political regime and institutions are against it. We tend to think of our president as having all of this authority, and constitutionally in foreign policy he should. But the reality is that unless that he agrees with the blob's foreign policy consensus, he has rather limited powers to shift the course of the Titanic.
You know, George, with the loss on the part of the Ukrainians of, let's say, for example, Odessa, well, would that focus the mind? Because we've, and I don't want to chew up time here, we've gone through every single process since this advent of the special military operation. And this year we had Anchorage, then the meeting in Budapest, and all the while, not quickly, but very systematically, the Russian forces are moving west. What's going to focus their mind? Or is that just, again, am I being too logical? Go ahead.
Yes, I think so. I think what's focusing their minds right now is Trump only has three more years to go. And maybe even we're into an election cycle, and then there'll be a new leader emerging. And then their calculation is, as things stand, given how unpopular Trump is, his polls numbers are bleak, the Democrats will be back. Therefore, they only have to last now another 3 years.
But can Ukraine last? Can Ukraine last that long?
Well, that's why that's a very good question. And that's why they're thinking of all sorts of ways to keep the Ukraine show on the road for another 3 years. And hence this pressure. I mean, it's this intense pressure to get their hands on this whatever it is, 300 billion euros, in order to, well, we can do this, you know, we can lend this money out for the next 2-3 years, and then Ukraine survives, and then we get, you know, President, Gavin Newsom, and, you know, he will probably run on the theme of, we need to, recreate our allies. We need to support NATO, greatest alliance ever, and everything will be back to the same. But in the meantime, I mean, they are trying to, engineer, and I guess that's what we're going to talk about. They're trying to whip up this fervor that, you know, Ukraine is on the front line. If Ukraine falls, then we all fall. This is the end of...
That's the second part of the program here. Mark, can Ukraine last another 3 years?
That's a good question, and that depends on, first of all, a continued flow of money, which the Europeans at the moment are scrambling for and don't seem able to find. And then, I mean, there's no question that they can't provide them enough weapons to win the conflict, or the types of weapons, or anything like that at this point. On for another few years until there's a political regime change in the U.S. and they feel that they are more ready for direct war with Russia. Well, if the Kiev regime opens up the conscription for below the age of 25, if they bring in women, and there was a headline in the Washington Post just a couple of weeks ago that Ukraine can't win without women, and buffing up all women drone operators.
All right, I'm going to jump in here. We're going to talk about who's going to win and who's going to lose in the next part of the program. All right, gentlemen, we're going to go to a short break, and after that short break, we'll continue our discussion on some real news. Stay with RT. Welcome back to Crosstalk Bullhorns, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. We're going to talk about NATO now. George, the Secretary General of NATO, Mark Rutte, I have a nickname for him, but I'm not going to use it here. He came out with quite an extraordinary speech, which I think will go down in history. It's covered by, you know, snippets in Western media as bravado and resolve and Churchill and all the other stuff here. But if you actually read it, and we went through it very carefully earlier, this is a remarkable document. It is preparing Europe for a World War II-style conflict. This is a conflict of choice, George.
It is a conflict of choice. And of course, he did several things in that speech. I mean, first of all, he invoked Ronald Reagan's talk of the evil empire. I mean, that's going back more than 40 years. And therefore saying, Ronald Reagan talked about an evil empire. And then he immediately said, and President Putin is seeking to restore the Russian empire. You know, so that, in other words, that is the evil empire. And so, and he then talked about this threat to Europe that is coming from Russia. And then he said, we have to get ready. All of us have to get ready for wars on the European continent that our grandfathers and great-grandfathers fought. So this was explicitly said, yes, this is coming. This is coming. He said this in Germany. The speech was delivered in Germany. And of course, the Germans were kind of purring about all of this. And then, but this goes together with Chancellor Merz now openly talking about the reintroduction of conscription. So at the moment, it's on a voluntary basis. You kind of, you register, and then supposedly maybe they'll use you, maybe they won't use you. Now he's going to be, he's now talking about mandatory. There's going to be mandatory military service. And there's going to be more and more of this kind of talk. And really, they've never really provided any rationale for that. What's the great threat? But it's just moving along of its own momentum. And I think, and when you have speeches like this from the top NATO person, hey, we've got to get used to the idea of a continent-wide conflict that's going to take millions of lives, then you're essentially normalizing the state of war.
You know, Mark, on the one hand, you could see, you could make the case that this is just one huge bluff. And as we said in the first part of the program, looking for a black swan event to finally have the Americans come in with a military force. That's what they want. But even if it is a bluff, it does be, it has its own momentum. I mean, if they break their own rules, break international law, steal other countries' central bank assets. I mean, they're on a cascade. This is a cascade event. It is a self-fulfilling prophecy. Because if Europe seriously is going to be preparing for war, well, of course the Russians will too, Mark.
Yeah, I don't actually see this as a bluff at all. I think the European ruling elite en masse, vice a few exceptions in Hungary, Slovakia, now maybe a few in Czechia, are ideologically, through the messianic supremacist ideology of Western That's exceptionalism, it. Committed to conflict with Russia. I think the very existence of Russia as defiant geopolitically, as an alternative social conservative model to their postmodern liberalism, presents an affront to their ideology and to their worldview. And they believe it. Don't forget that just a couple weeks ago, a French official said that French parents need to come to grips, need to accept that they will have to sacrifice their children to fight Russia. For what? I mean, it's the Russians are just, the Europeans, as far as they're concerned, are mad. And they are, but it is not mad from incoherent position. They are very coherent and consistent like this. If you Google search Europe war with Russia, you will find all across, take any European country, take the political elite, the military elite, the intelligence services, they all say the same thing. War with Russia is coming in 3 years, in 5 years, and by 2030, whatever, and we need to be ready for it. We had German officials a couple of weeks ago saying a war could start tomorrow, right? War with Russia could start tomorrow, and we need to be ready for it. The reality of this is, after years of military neglect, after years, decades of political will to force to power neglect, after years of shuffling whatever military resources they had to a Kiev regime, NATO, particularly European NATO, is not ready for conflict, for direct conflict with a Russian military juggernaut that is far larger, far more experienced, and far more technologically and strategically capable than they were just a few years ago.
So, you know, Mark named all of these elite structures, okay? And of course, there's the ideological dimension, which is messianic and blinding. But George, what about the populace, the publics of Europe? I mean, Mark didn't mention them, okay? Has there ever been a referendum or an election on this? people that are actually supporting these policies are down in the polls. Okay, so the Ukraine project is an elite project. Going to war with Russia is equally an elite project, George.
It is an elite project, and I think that's why they're so busy right now to mobilize public support for it. So that's why they, you know, every day in all the newspapers and magazines are the stories about all the terrible things Russia is doing to us, the hybrid warfare, the disinformation campaigns, the drone attacks, the sabotage, the fires, the assassinations.
We can't forget the contraband cigarettes going over the border.
The contraband cigarettes. And so, you know, they obviously this is what they're doing. You know, sort of persuaded of the idea, which they obviously aren't persuaded right now, that Russia actually poses a threat. This isn't about Ukraine. No, it's not about Ukraine. It's what they're doing to us right now. This is the great threat. And of course, this goes together with their demand for the censorship of the internet, you know, the censorship of the social media, so that all kinds of rival views will be suppressed. And the European public, which of course has not supported this, but neither has it actively opposed it. They've gone along with it rather passively, which makes them quite easily malleable for when the moment comes. But ultimately, there's always they cannot fight this war against Russia without the United States. And that's really the key. That's right. The United States has to be brought in. That's why when they're putting forward these time frames, it's always, well, this war's going to take place 2029 or 2030. Yeah. Trump isn't going to be there. They're not going to get this war while Trump is there. But once Trump isn't there anymore, they got, particularly if they have a Democrat, and they know how the Democrats have been committed to this obsession with Russia since, I don't know, 10, 15 years. So once they're there, then it's going to be much easier to pull off. And I think that's the way they're doing is whipping up the hysteria now and laying the foundations for this upcoming war.
But, you know, Mark, you know, 3 years is a lifetime in politics. Even thinking in terms of what's going to happen before the midterms. Can Europe be prepared for a peer conflict with Russia in 3 years, 5 years?
Yeah, I don't think so.
I don't either.
Their attempts to ramp up, first of all, the problem with Europe, your military production, right? It would be, like Ukraine, a war of attrition, except on a much larger scale, with the potential at all the points of the slippery slope down into a strategic nuclear conflict. But military production and all of the European attempts and to a lesser extent American attempts to ramp up military production in the last few years have been completely overblown. The projections they've made, they haven't even come close to meeting them on artillery, shells, tank production, anything. They're way behind the line. And the problem, of course, is that European military industrial production is scattered among a dozen or so European countries, right? Yeah. With that are tailored for expensive boutique spending, specialized spending within a broader NATO framework. And it's just not fit for task. And there is no political will within Europe to solidify behind one, because every country, France, Germany, is looking out for their own, military political pork. No, they're not. I mean, unless they all want to buy American weapons, and even then, U.S. military production is not fit to the task. U.S. can't even come up with enough Patriot interceptors for its own purposes, much less for a war with Russia either. So this is another example of them living kind of delusionally. They have a underestimation of Russia and overestimation of their own capabilities.
Yeah, but George, there is a maniacal way around all of this, and that's a preemptive attack.
Yeah, I think so. A preemptive attack, some kind of a staged incident. This, I think, is the thing, the false flag incident. And, you know, there are all sorts of tensions that can easily be stirred up. I mean, you can create an incident in, you know, Kaliningrad. All you have to do is create some story that, oh, Russia is using weapons of mass destruction in Ukraine. I mean, you know, they used a dirty nuclear bomb. Boom, you've got the public is ready for it. So all of that can absolutely happen. And, you know, I tend to think that if the Europeans and if the Americans do put their mind to it, if they really do decide to massively increase their military production, massively increase their industrial output, I think they could be ready for a war in within a few years. I mean, you know, you can look back to the days before World War II.
Yeah, the problem is the American economy
could be ready for a war.
I don't know. This has to be much more vertically integrated, and that the NATO in Europe is not built that way. But we'll see here. We're ending on a very glum note, gentlemen. Again, the conversation within the European elites, the Atlanticists, and this is a wanton choice on their part. Very depressing. I want to thank my guests in Budapest, also here in Moscow. And of course, I want to thank our viewers for watching us here at RT. See you next time. And remember, Crosstalk rules.